from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made on a warm September morning. A woman slipped into a sundress and sandals and then took a look in the mirror. On that beautiful day, she had one overriding thought. Is this skirt too short for a woman my age? The woman in the dress was Joan London. You know her as a longtime anchor for ABC's Good Morning America. She's an author. Perhaps you know her as the new host of Second Opinion. London's newest book is titled, Why Did I Come Into This Room? A Candid Conversation About Aging. And she tells the story of approaching age 65 and asking herself what kind of clothing style she could still pull off. Ripped jeans? Leggings? That sundress I just mentioned? Her book is instantly relatable, aimed mainly at women, but with many themes relevant for all of us as we consider how our bodies and our minds evolve, how we think about ourselves, what age we think of ourselves as being, why that matters, and how we view our own futures, how we get up in the morning, how we push ourselves to do what maybe we don't want to. Some of those themes will no doubt be featured on the new season of Second Opinion, which is filming this week right here at WXXI, by the way. London will also interview some of the biggest names in healthcare, including, for example, Dr. Anthony Fauci. She's got a new podcast she's doing. Joan London is the host of Second Opinion, former Good Morning America anchor, and a long resume, which I'll let you say as much as you like. It's an honor to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
How did you end up with Second Opinion? What a coup for public broadcasting to have you.
Well, fortunately, they called and invited me, and they asked me to host the show. And, you know, I remember when I left Good Morning America, my attorney looked at me and said, your greatest challenge moving forward is going to be knowing what to say no to. Mm. And it's true, you know, and I mean, you can't even imagine all the things that come to me, including Dancing with the Stars every year, and thank God I'm smart enough to say no. Because what I bring to any project that I work on is my decades of experience and trustability and credibility as a news journalist. And so when the Second Opinion came to me, it was so right in my lane that I just jumped at it. And we just shot our very first show, and we talked about heart disease in women. And everybody always thinks of heart disease as a man's disease. Well, it's not. More women die from heart attacks than men. Now, the reason why is that men have that, like, Hollywood heart attack that's crushing pain, and they go to the hospital. We tend not to go to the hospital. Our symptoms are much more vague, and we have to go pick our kids up at school, and we have to make dinner. So that's why, because we don't go seek help, is why women die more often. And we had Star Jones with us, who really, she went through open heart surgery. So, you know, it's a combination of hearing it from a real person, a patient, sometimes a celebrity, and then having doctors on who are really the experts who can explain it all. I love the format of the show.
Well, we're certainly, it's a very proud institution here, and it's just wonderful to have you on board. The new episodes, by the way, that are shooting this week won't start rolling out until January, right?
Yeah, it's January.
Which is, you know, I was talking to Joan before the program. I mean, talk about a challenge. You've got Dr. Anthony Fauci, I think, today, and that is a big enough challenge on its own. But for an interview with Fauci that's going to air in January, how do you focus that?
Well, it makes me think back to, I have a podcast, which we can talk about too, that's starting September 30th. And I was interviewing, it was shot at the Cleveland Clinic. And I had all these experts on talking about telehealth. But the conversation in mid-February was about in 5-10 years, how telehealth was going to disrupt medical care like Amazon disrupted retail. And then all of a sudden, the pandemic hits and everybody's doing telehealth instantly. Like it changed overnight. So, you know, it really left me remembering how much you had to be concerned about events of the world. So I had to go back and lay down a little bit of a disclaimer that was shot 2 weeks before the pandemic started. And in the case of Dr. Fauci, I actually was surprised to learn some of the things that I learned doing research to figure out how I wanted to interview him. And we all think of like coronavirus. This is this crazy new thing. Coronaviruses have been around for decades, and researchers have been studying them for decades. Like influenza, it's like the common cold. They all come from coronaviruses. So, you know, that's why they call this one a novel coronavirus. So I can ask him a lot of questions about the coronavirus, how they mutate, why they mutate, what about herd immunity, mm-hmm. would that actually work? So there's a lot of things you can ask that won't become outdated 6 months from now. But you have to think a little harder to make sure you come up with those questions.
A tremendous challenge. How much you have a long history in journalism. I'm sure you've wanted to be very involved. You're not someone who was just hired to come in and read. I mean, I imagine you're very involved in idea planning, themes, et cetera. And my guess is your book, there's a plenty in your book that will be reflected at times in conversations on the program.
Absolutely. You know, I said to the producers when we started this, I hope you like a person who's like involved and contributing, because I'm a very contributory person. So, and they were like, yes,
I have an email from Fiona. She's already raving about you.
So I've been on the phone with them. We've had more Zooms and I've taken the scripts and what we call Jonized them. And I helped with booking also, you know, to get some of the people that I interview all the time for other things. You know, when the pandemic hit, and we were all in our homes. I don't even know how. I mean, I just decided like a couple days in, I think I'll do a FaceTime live every day at 1 o'clock. And I'll book some guests and I'll talk. Well, it became quite a thing and I had quite a following. And they were actually rather disappointed with me when June rolled around and I said, I'm going on summer vacation. Bye. But I mean, my husband would come walk through my office and say, why are you doing this? Like, you're on the phone all the time, booking guests, interviewing them, writing, and then doing the interviews. Like you're doing this, what, for fun? I said, actually, yes, because this is what I do. And it's just great staying connected, hearing the questions that people are asking. And I, you know, I said to you as I walked in here today, you'll see by all the projects that I work on that at the heart and soul of me is disseminating information, but really the dissemination of wellness information and helping people, whether it's their own health, their family health, nutritional health, aging. You know, if you go back and you look at the books I've done over the years, I started with healthy cooking. And why? Because I had gained a lot of weight having three children while hosting Good Morning America. And I went through a year of like really regaining my own health and losing that weight and becoming healthy again. So I wrote it and it was tremendously successful. And the publisher came back and said, all right, we want another book.
That's the problem. You were successful with one.
Yes. So I remember I looked at my book agent and said, I feel like I just squeezed every last thought out of my brain. And they want another book. And he said, you will always write about that which you want to know more about. And he was so right. My next book was Healthy Living, and it went much more into the soul and into the management of stress and into letting go of things that, you know, weigh you down. When I was leaving Good Morning America, I wrote a book called The Bend in the Road is Not the End of the Road. It was all about dealing with change. When we had two sets of twins, by the way, you know, when people
at what age, by the way,
when people introduce me, they always say she covered five presidents and three Olympics and blah, blah, blah. And then at the end, and in her spare time, she has seven children.
It's amazing.
And my first line can always be, it doesn't make any difference how many presidents I've covered. It's always the seven kids that get the applause.
Well, I mean, you say in the book, you know, that you spent your 50s, you know, and you said you hit your 50s with a lot of energy, feeling, you know, great. You had gone through some of that health transformation.
Yes.
And I guess good enough to have those twins.
Yeah. And it's a personal decision that everyone should have. I've always been kind of a type A, energizer bunny. My husband says you run circles around people in your office. Like one of them will go with you on these trips. The other, you go on these trips, but you go on all the trips. But it's, you know, it's been my life forever. It was my life at Good Morning America when I was raising three kids and I was all over the world and up at 3:30 in the morning, in case anyone wonders what time do you get up for that show, 3:30. So it's none of it feels overwhelming or unusual to me because it's a normal life to be busy. I'll tell you what scares me. Not doing all of that. Like the idea of like retirement and So what are you going to do in your retirement? Mm-hmm. That to me seems, you know, so far off because I love my life so much.
Well, and you have there's a lot in this book that kind of to me, this book is it's lighthearted at times, but it's also very serious. I think this is very direct about what's coming everyone's way with aging, depending on what age you are. Also saying that, you know, you don't have to just sort of accept what you perceive as the negative aspects of aging, while also knowing that some of it you can't change. Not everything. You can't stop everything.
Yeah. You know. I think the reason what, you know, it's funny because, so then what would I have normal, what was the obvious thing I should be writing about now if I'm going to write about that which I want to know about? And right before this, I wrote a book called Had I Known. It was because I went through breast cancer and I decided within 24 hours, I completely changed my focus of how I was going to go down that path because my dad was a doctor. He was a cancer surgeon. And I always thought I grew up to be a doctor, but then I worked in a hospital for 3 months before going away to college and found out pretty quickly that stitches and scalpels were not going to be part of my future. But I had never, I always kind of had a little bit of a regret that I hadn't carried on my dad's legacy by becoming a doctor. And maybe that's part of why I've always been so focused on health and wellness and women's happiness. But here was this opportunity. And notice what I say. It was a cancer diagnosis. Mm-hmm. But in my head, I all of a sudden realized that it was this strange but very obvious opportunity for me to pick up that baton and run it in and carry on my dad's legacy. I took my phone into every appointment I went on. I showed them and talked about what radiation was like, what chemo was like. And I've had so many people say to me, you took the scary out of it, because I knew what to expect and I knew what was coming. And so I really kind of devoted a year or two to speaking at every cancer event around the country. And I still do, but I also wanted to not just be defined as just that. And what was so then now what was affecting my life? The aging process, mm-hmm. obviously. So the more, and I think you probably know, I right in the beginning of the book, I talk about going to Morocco, taking my daughters. I wanted them to see them a part of the world that they didn't even have running water and electricity in most of the places.
You said glamping before it was glamping.
Yeah, we went glamping before it was anything. We went out in the Sahara Desert. Yeah. They take you by jeep out in the middle of two dunes and you're in tents, very fancy tents. But those my girls got to see that there were people on another part of the same earth, the same planet they live on, that were so different. It was like going back in time, 100 years. But as we were coming back from the Sahara Desert, there were these sheep herders. And our driver / translator, he pulled over the side of the road, jumped out of the car, because there was also a big tent out there. And he asked the sheep herders if we, or goat herders, whatever they were, could we come and talk to you and, go into your tent? And they said yes. So a couple of them came with us, took us into this tent, and there was this obviously older woman in the tent. I couldn't tell how old she was because she was the Sahara Desert, She would have been a good in a commercial for sunscreen here in the United States. And we were asking them about their lives. They had no television, no radio, no phones, no iPhones, no nothing. They went by the stars, the moon, the sun, and the seasons. And at one point I said, would you mind terribly if I asked you how old you were? She looked at me like I was from Mars. She had no idea what I meant by age. She was born out in the desert, and she just lived her life. And I got back in the car, and I thought, wow, what freedom. She'll never say, I packed up this donkey like a 20-year-old, because she just considered herself able to do that.
Meanwhile, as you say, we count our birthdays, and birthdays can be very negative events for us.
Yeah, I came back to the U.S. where, of course, we are so tied to our age here in this country that we're defined by it. You could take five women who are all 62. One can be a triathlete, mm-hmm. and one can be a total couch potato, but everyone will describe those five women as 62. It's probably the worst descriptive adjective that you could possibly use. And I started thinking about it, and that's how I start the book out, is the mind, because it's mind, body, and soul, the way I broke it up. But how old would you be if you really, honestly, truly did not know your age? What age would you be?
35.
And what age are you?
41.
All right. I would be 45, and I turned 70 this past weekend. And by the way, I turned 70 in some other altered universe where they have, I guess, my birth certificate. But in my universe, I just turned 45. That's what I see in the mirror. That's how I feel. That's how I think. So I'm going to live my life that way, you know, by my biological age, not by my birth certificate age. And I just think that age in this country so limits people. Like a woman will say, well, I can't do that anymore. I mean, you know, right, at my age, I shouldn't do that anymore. And I just find it so limiting that I wanted to expand their horizon and how they looked at themselves.
Well, and you do write in the book, though, some of the things that, if you're asking me the age question, I'll say 35. There are moments where I'll see a photograph of an iPhone pic, something in the mirror, a little flint of gray or a little more scalp. And
yeah,
I'll say, I don't know about 35. I want to be 30. I want to feel 30. And you write about that in the book.
Yeah.
That there's going to come these moments,
yep,
where you go, is that, that's not what I think I look like, and how you sort of psychologically deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, I have those times where I'll start to walk out of the bathroom and I'll like stop and back up and say, I think I just saw my mother in the mirror. Like, oh my God. But it really is mind over matter. I forget who said it, that age, if you don't mind, if you don't mind your aging.
If you don't mind it, it don't matter.
It don't matter, yeah. Satchel Paige or somebody who said that. But it is true that it's a little bit of a head job, you know, that you, and if you just wait around, but it's not just that. You have to keep yourself open to opportunities. And if you just kind of let age happen to you, let life happen to you, then, you know, good luck with that. But if you kind of pivot, which people do in their 50s and 60s, you come to that point where there's a saying with age comes wisdom. And it's true, because you somehow get to this point where you're not on that ladder anymore and you give yourself permission to step back, look back and say, wow, I dealt with a lot of stuff in my life. Pat yourself on the back, kind of job well done. But also while you're there, say, what did I always dream of doing? Didn't I ever do that? Well, guess what? You got the next 20, 30 years the way we're all living to be so much older these days. And am I the person that I want to be? And of course, if you made it to the end of the book, you know that my last chapter is, I want to be cremated. It's my last chance for a smoking hot body.
Don't make me laugh at that, Joan.
But in that chapter, I do an exercise. I have you do an exercise where you write your own obituary and your own eulogy. And that is not a morbid exercise. It is an internal exercise that can be incredibly eye-opening. And I have to give credit to Stephen Covey, who wrote The 7 Habits of Highly Successful People, I think was the name of the book. We were both on a big, I think it was a Tony Robbins speaking tour, and he was right before me. And I watched him up on stage take 26,000 people in the arena, had them close their eyes and said, all right, we're going to go on a trip. Keep your eyes closed. We're going to your funeral. Oh, look who's coming in the door. It's everybody from the office. Now, as they're coming by, what do you think they're saying? Gee, she was so considerate and compassionate. She was such a good friend. Or was she like, you know, Debbie Downer and always putting people down? You couldn't trust her. And then what are they saying about you in your eulogy? And if you write out what you hope, and if you're a little bit of a control freak, like file it with the rest of your family and tell them to read it at your funeral. My mom did that. I sat with my mom the day right after my father, he was crashed in our family airplane, because he was a doctor who was an avid pilot, and in an era where there were no specialists, and he used to fly all over and help with difficult cancer surgeries. And when he crashed, I sat with my mom as she wrote out his eulogy. And then years later, but by the way, only in her 60s, she said, I want to write my eulogy. I want to make sure it's what I want.
I like this idea.
And I sat with her, and she wrote, by the way, she like did a primetime show, you know, with who's going to sing and all. But I put that in my file, and I had that with me. And I might have taken a little liberty, but essentially she had her eulogy read at her funeral. And if you do that, the real purpose in that, in this, not so much to be a control freak, but you have from right now, this minute, until the end of your days to work on being that person, how you want to be described. If you want to be more patient, like when I did mine, I want to be more patient with my teenagers. And by the way, that's a pretty big challenge. They're the eye rollers. And I talk about in the book, because I figure I can't ask other people to do this without going through it myself. I want to listen more and talk less, which, of course, people are like, what? You make your life talking. I said, yeah, I'm full of incredible stories. I'm great at a cocktail party, but I don't have to be telling those all the time. And as you elicit other people's stories, it makes them feel good and it adds to your repertoire. And so I go through all these different things that I would like to have people say in my eulogy. And so just to kind of get them started on it. So I think, you know, they're just things that I've picked up on being backstage, listening to Stephen Covey do that routine that I want to pass on. That's what writing books is about. It's about all the information that you collect along the way, having the desire to share it all with other people.
Joan Lendon is my guest, the author of Why Did I Come Into This Room? A Candid Conversation About Aging. She is the new host of Second Opinion, and you can see Second Opinion on PBS across the country. These episodes that they are shooting in Rochester this week here at WXXI, those episodes will start rolling out in January, and the crew is so excited that Joan is part of this. Of course, listeners know Joan from a long career with ABC and Good Morning America. And speaking of writing your eulogy, you didn't get to write this, but my guess is you were gratified. I have a clip from your last morning of Good Morning America, 1997, and I want to play this for a reason.
Okay.
I watched the whole last episode, by the way.
Okay.
And I want to play this for a reason, because what you're going to hear from Charlie in this clip is his comments on the ground that you and some of your colleagues, but Barbara Walters and others, but really you as well, especially on GMA, were breaking as a woman in an industry often dominated by men. Because this book that you wrote now about aging for women has a lot of the kind of advice about don't accept your age as, you know, don't, who cares what the number is? The number that matters to you is 45 for you. Well, let's listen to what Charlie was saying. This is back in 1997. Let's listen first.
As pioneers, they were forced to show they could be tough and authoritative to make inroads in what had been and still is more than it should be a man's world. Joan changed a lot of things. She was the first woman on television to share 3 pregnancies and put her pregnant stomach over the desk, not under it. And some of the male executives around here then didn't like that. She was the first woman on television to publicly face the problems with which many women grappled, the problems of raising a family while holding down a full-time job. 17 years ago, Joan started demonstrating that you can do both. You can be successful in the workplace and successful at home. And you in the audience responded to that. Because you can't fake it on live television, you knew again, correctly, that while she was talking to all the big names, while she was as high profile as anyone in a high profile business, her heart was also at home. People sensed that for all her success in public, her heart was very much in the carpool line, at the ballet lesson, and in the teacher's conference. In the past 17 years, there have been real changes in women's roles, in the way women are perceived, and in the way they perceive themselves. And Joan has been a real part of and symbol for those changes.
That's pretty...
I love Charlie.
That's pretty cool stuff. But that's 1997. It's 23 years ago.
Wow.
Has enough changed from that day to now, the kinds of changes that you would want to see, the opportunities that women have, the double standards? Charlie talked about the fact that the male executives at ABC didn't like that the viewers could see your pregnant stomach. I mean, that stuff I would hope in 2020 is less so. How do you see it?
And to be totally honest, it was because they wanted to see younger women on that show that I was taken off that show. And they replaced Charlie as well. And they replaced us with 30-something lookalikes. And do you remember their names?
I don't.
Well, they were gone in 6 months. I mean, it was a mistake. It was a calculated mistake on the part of executives who thought that the audience wanted younger. And I feel that that was really underestimating the audience. That audience, I think, had a very good respect for experience, for loyalty, for who they had spent their mornings with for. You know, I was there 3 years before I became the host, for 20 years. It took them about 17. So they grabbed Charlie back, and I was already gone. And so Diane came in, and supposedly just for a few months while they found someone, then she stayed a long time. But it took them 17 years to build themselves back up to the number one position. And now it's like a real, you know, kind of horse race between ABC and NBC. So, you know, that was just not letting a woman age. And just because we age, that doesn't mean, what do they think, our brain gets smaller? Like, well, what's up with this? I had so many women write me and say, when I was staying on the air pregnant, thank you for showing my husband or my boss that as your belly grows bigger, your brain does not grow smaller. But, you know, and I'll tell you, so much has changed. I think women are allowed, for the most part, to, you know, to age. However, you often see them just kind of siphoned off, and they replace them with a 30-year-old woman in, you know, 6-inch Jimmy Choo heels. it's the audience, though, casts their vote on these things. The other thing that's really changed so much so is that when we were on Good Morning America, we reported the news, the real news, not our opinion of the news. When we interviewed people, our mission, Charlie and I shared this mission, and David Hartman as well before Charlie, that when we did an interview or a debate between two people, we were there to elicit the facts of a story and their opinions. But at the end of the interview, if we had done our job properly, you at home would not know which side of the issue that we were on. And that is how we always conducted ourselves. And over the past, 23 years since I left? Over the past 23 years, there's been a transition to opinion news, and in some cases with some networks, just downright political news. And, you know, needless to say, I don't think that that's been a change for the better. It's also a matter of, I remember the day that CNN started, and we were all like there in the newsroom looking at this thing saying, how are they going to do news continually for 24 hours a day?
Yeah.
What are they going to talk about? Well, of course, over time, we learned that, you know, what really happened at that point, that along with the simultaneously iPhones becoming, or cell phones becoming, something that everybody had all over the world. What changed is that nothing could go on in a corner of the world and the rest of the world not know about it. And there's a good part of that. So nobody could get away with, you know, political, murdering a group of people or taking over a country without everyone knowing. And I think that's the good part about it. But what happened is once CNN came on, then you started having all these other channels. And today there are so many different media platforms on air and on your laptop that there's always this race to be the first to get it on and the race to figure out some other way to cover it. And in that can become diluted news. Or, you know, the first person tells the second person, tells the third person, pretty soon it's not what the first person said. So I think there has become a concern for misinformation. And, of course, in this world we live in, there's even a concern for disinformation. And what disinformation is deliberate misinformation. In fact, I recently took on, I was very happy that they asked me, I took on being ambassador for MediaWise for seniors. They started this campaign, MediaWise, the Poynter Institute, started this campaign. They're a lot of the fact checkers. for high school students and about 3 years ago, then expanded it to college students. And then they realized that maybe the most vulnerable group out there were seniors. And I think they don't understand as well, you know, algorithms and how things get picked up and brought to, you know, in front of their eyeballs.
The manipulated.
And they grew up in a time when they believed, they could believe. It was Walter Cronkite. You believed him. You believed your doctor. You didn't go for a second opinion. They grew up in that world. And today's world is very different. And it's important that we go out and try to do campaigns like this to educate them. What is fact? What is fiction? What is fact and what is opinion? And what is downright disinformation? And how can you check that out? I mean, we have elections coming up and pandemics to worry about. I mean, pandemic misinformation could be a life and death situation. So I'm very, very happy that I'm involved in that. The two ambassadors for that program are Christiane Annenpoor and myself. She takes the global view and I take the U.S. view.
Well, obviously, we think that Second Opinion has made a phenomenal hire. And one other point on this, to kind of close the loop on this idea of how we think about age and what we think our own age might be, and frankly, how society views it, how this country views age. So you were 47 on your last day in GMA.
Yeah.
About 10 years ago, I saw a Funny or Die sketch with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, you know, of Veep and Seinfeld fame, Amy Poehler, Tina Fey. And Julia Louis-Dreyfus was turning 50, and they were holding a party for her in this like this bucolic field, and they had bottles of wine and a cake. And they, I cannot on public radio say what they were celebrating exactly as they said it, but it was her last desirable day because she was going to turn 50. And the joke in the industry of broadcasting is, well, that's it. But because you're a woman and you're 50 – you're no longer viewed in those terms by the men who are the executives.
Yes.
So you had a nice career. It's over. And it was a sketch, but it was very, very popular because of how many women related to the idea that a certain age number meant that you were either no longer desirable or you couldn't wear ripped jeans as you wrote in the book, et cetera. And so to me, your book helps counter a view of yourself. But the question is, how do you get society to stop being addicted to this idea of women need to be this or that?
Well, that's really why I wrote the book. It's because when women start having these expanding waistlines or leaky bladders, they think of themselves as, uh-oh, what's going wrong with me? I'm really breaking down. Am I as appealing? Am I sexy anymore? Am I relevant? And when they experience that just within themselves, and these things are not only annoying, they're worrisome to women and they're embarrassing. So they tend not to even talk to them about them to their doctors. And that means that there are lots of fixes for a lot of these things. And if we take it so that it's not, these aren't taboo subjects anymore. And I threw it all out there, but I threw it all out there with a healthy sense of humor. But I gave real takeaway and said, this happens to every single woman. Don't feel like there's something wrong with you. And if we can open this up, you know, nobody ever talked about breast cancer. It was like, hush, hush. And then Betty Ford came out and said, I have breast cancer. And it opened the door for everyone to be able to talk about breast cancer. And that has completely changed. I have a woman come on my Facebook page now and say, I just had a mastectomy. Does anybody know where do I buy a bathing suit? I'll have 30 women come in right behind her. Go to this catalog. We live in that world, and it has made that horrible path of battling breast cancer an easier path, a more supported path. And that's what I want writing about age and the aging process. That's what I wanted to do to the aging process for every woman out there. And by the way, for men too. I mean, it's written for women, but I have men all the time coming on Twitter and Facebook saying, by the way, I took my wife's book and I read it. I read your book and I think I understand my wife much better now. So, and other women say, I wish every woman when she's in her 20s would read this because she would know what's coming and she wouldn't feel bad about herself. Because that's what I want to counteract.
Well, I certainly learned a lot about menopause. I learned about a lot of subjects. And yes, the book tackles sex. Tackles libido.
Yep.
And how to view changes in certain things. again, without feeling like it's taboo.
Yeah.
Like you can't talk about it. And I think some of that is what drives this idea of society that, well, 50 years old means X, or 40 years old means X, or 60 means X. I think that this kind of book will help change some of that, some of the strictures that we have. After our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about podcasts that you're working on because you don't have enough going on. Talk about what else you're excited about with Second Opinion. And I want to close the loop on a couple other questions I have regarding journalism and perhaps how she views journalism today. Joan London, our guest, the host of Second Opinion, which is shooting right here at WXXI in Rochester for their next season, which rolls out in January. This is our only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, former Rochesterians now living on the West Coast and living through one of the strangest and sometimes most horrifying weather events you can imagine. The wildfires that have turned all of the western skies orange for days or weeks on end. What it's been like to live in that kind of environment. What they want all of us in the East to know. That's Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Brad writes to say that GMA has never been the same since. Nice to hear Joan London here. Do you like hearing that?
Well, you know, I hear that a lot.
I'm sure you do.
You know, we have these TBTs, and a lot of time on Throwback Thursdays, I post pictures from my days at GMA, and I'll get seriously like 400 comments, and at least half of them say, I don't watch it anymore. I only watched it back then. You know, that's when the show was a real news show. And I mean, of course, I love to hear that they loved me with Charlie or prior to that with David. But it also saddens me, you know, because I hate that we are at that point in time where news has been depicted as something that's self-centered, fake news. I mean, as a longtime journalist my entire life, it's just heartbreaking.
I think this administration is difficult to cover.
Yeah.
And I think it's because so many norms, and I know I don't want to derail into a conversation on norms, but I do think that there have been every election is the most important election of a lifetime. But I understand why people feel like things are a little different this time. I have an 8-year-old son. I mean, he sort of intrinsically feels that there is a lot of vitriol, especially coming from the president and certain elected leaders. And so I think it's probably harder to cover this race than many others.
Yeah.
Having said that, I think you make an important point. Because of this, all the panoply of options we have, people can say, well, I'm conservative. I'm going to pick this station or this radio station, this television station, this website, which maybe what didn't happen in the 80s and 90s as much. And I think that's hurting this country.
It is hurting this country. And in my opinion, it's hurting the news industry. Because when we had networks come on to be completely Republican, I mean, just down, you know, like with Fox, then I think stations like CNN felt compelled to raise the opposite view. When in the past, they were just straight out, let's see what's going on in that part of the world. Here's the news. And so I think that because when one happens, it kind of almost forces another to become politicized as well. And that's just a bad transition that we've all experienced in this country. And, you know, right now, I think of, you know, there's so many people that I talk to that feel like me. We've spent the last 20 years trying to close the divide and not have a racial divide in this country. And it's like it just took 10, 12 months to just blow a big hole in that. Mm. And that also to me is just incredibly heartbreaking.
I also wanted to ask you, given the work that you're doing on age, there's a lot of talk in this presidential election about age. The two oldest top of the ticket candidates combined in history.
Yeah.
Joe Biden, of course, would be the oldest elected president if he's elected. Too much talk about age? Is it appropriate? How do you see it?
Well, I guess you have to talk about it to a certain extent. You know, I think a lot of people that might have voted for John McCain didn't vote for John McCain because of his choice of a running mate, because they were concerned about his age and might he pass. Joe Biden, I forget how old John McCain was when he actually ran, But, Joe Biden, I've interviewed him a gazillion times over the years, as well as his wife, Jill. You have these people, and I don't mean to be partisan. I can tell you that George Bush Sr., I remember being at the White House on the last night. It was the last party they had. It was a Christmas party because, of course, he would be moving out in January. And I remember talking to Barbara Bush, and she said, I'm like already like planning the house down in Texas. And we walked into George's office, and she said, but look, George hasn't even packed up a box because he just feels like he hasn't finished here. And he really felt like he had had it in him to do the next 4 years. And he had spent his entire life dedicated to service to the nation. And I think that that's, having interviewed the Bidens so many times, I think that's kind of where what Joe Biden is also feeling at this point in time.
McCain was 72 in 2008, yeah.
72. Okay, so they're all in the same realm.
Yeah, Trump's 73.
And he's 73, and I think
Biden's
77, yeah. Well, look, you're talking to a person that just turned 70, okay? I intend to be all there and working like crazy in 7 years. So I'm not going to be of the opinion, certainly right now at this age and stage, that I'm not going to be fabulous to do something at the age of 77. I might question 87, but not 77. 77 today is not like 77 20 years ago. We are different.
And we're living longer.
We're living better. They say that the person who's going to live to be 120 has already been born. Just think about that. Now, and aging is also relevant because almost every country in the world right now has an aging population. It's not just us. In fact, there are other countries, Japan, China, different ones that are aging faster than us. But what it means is that as people live longer, that by 2030, there will be far more people in this country over 65 than there will be under 18. And caregiving is going to become a huge mm-hmm. issue. If anybody's listening that has a kid in college, tell them to go into gerontology. We are going to have a huge need for gerontologists. So aging is really important when you look at it from the standpoint of a country and how we manage a country. It will become a financial crisis, and it will become a social crisis. Because we'll just have, it'll become a crisis with Social Security. So this, as you can tell, I'm like, this is my passion.
Well, I got to ask you a little bit about technology. And okay. By the way, I'll go ahead and read a comment. Valerie just says, about 35 years ago, I took a course from Ashley Montague, the anthropologist, who got me thinking. He said, we are totally focused on ages, as you have said. His solution was, once you turn 50, subtract 1 year each birthday. So currently I'm 27 while my daughter is 45.
I like that. Thank you for that one.
Thank you, Valerie. I want to talk a little bit about technology. You just mentioned Throwback Thursday.
All right.
And you're doing a podcast. So I'm going to make a general statement that is not at all meant to apply to everybody. But generally speaking, people in their 70s may be less familiar with TBT
right.
or podcasts.
Yeah.
Not always.
Not on my Facebook page.
No, I hear you. I met a 55-year-old winemaker 1 year who told me, he said, I've just got a Facebook page. I have a cell phone. This is about a decade ago. He said, my view is I don't really like all this technology, but if this is where the world's going, I'd like to not be irrelevant.
Absolutely.
And so he said, I'm forcing myself to at least stay current. I don't have to use it all the time. I don't have to make it my life. But you say at least, I think at one point, maybe if not 2 points in the book, I think maybe when you talked about the trip in the Sahara, that you're glad when you were there with your daughters that you didn't have cell phones, snap and pics, because it would
yep.
have taken you a little bit out of that moment.
Absolutely.
So how do you balance the importance of staying relevant with technology, but also saying, hey, I can still be a little curmudgeonly about it. I think the old way is better.
I will be honest that the day I joined Facebook, I was so excited. My biggest regret, my biggest unhappiness when I left Good Morning America was being disconnected from all those people mm-hmm. who had gotten up every morning and spent their mornings with me, and they were fans. And all of a sudden, I was completely they were ripped away from me because there was no Facebook. We didn't have any. Charlie and I didn't have laptops at that point.
Barely even email.
Yeah. So when I got on Facebook, my husband said, if you think they're going to be able to answer every one of those people, like, think again. But I got to tell you, I answer almost all of them. And it takes up a lot of time. And yes, I do have a staff in the office that does help me with some of it. But I kind of love it. Now, that is something I'm going to probably look forward to maybe in retirement, that I disconnect a lot more. Being in the industry, the way I'm in an industry, because I don't just, you know, I'm not just an anchor for one show. I work with a lot. I work with the American Heart Association. I work with different, I work with a place for mom and seniors. I work with all these, media-wise, I work with all these different entities that have messages that they want to get across. And I am a messenger. I deliver those messages. So I need to really be relevant and up to date on social media. But it is incredibly consuming. And you have to be really careful. I mean, I'll give you an example. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, loved interviewing her. She died the other day. She was an important figure in our world, and I wanted to post. But unfortunately, in today's atmosphere, if I had posted, I would have had people saying, oh, she's so liberal and that.
Another media liberal.
And it has nothing to do with that.
Right, right.
I would like to have been able to honor her, but I've been able to keep my social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, everything, and Facebook, free of vitriol. Free of...
You're the first.
I'm telling you, you go on and you look, you are not going to find people yelling at each other, because I'm really careful. Because I want people who are following me to feel like I'm keeping them safe and that they're not going to have people throwing... And I'll tell you, when someone does it, you'll see 10 people come on below it and say, we don't do that here on this site.
Right.
People are protective of me.
I think that's great.
You know, I had to have chemo when I went through cancer and I lost my hair. I was bald for a year. And when my hair grew back to what you see right now, my husband said, you know what? You don't have to grow your hair back long. I like it that way. So I've kept it this way. People now feel that they can be so anonymous that they can say anything, no matter how nasty it is. And I'll have people say, you look a lot older with that hairdo. Your ears are too big for that hairdo. And I've just had to, like, you know, and fortunately, I don't have to say anything because all my followers, like, They take that person down in a heartbeat.
But women take it so much more than men.
I know.
It is true.
I know. But it's sad that people feel that they can say things because they're not saying them to you, to your face. But they really are, because I read my posts. Yeah, I don't have a company. There are companies that do that for you. And I've never used a company like that.
Does it ever hurt?
Of course it does. Are you kidding?
Well,
yeah.
I mean, you seem very grounded.
I'm a human being.
You're very grounded at letting that stuff sort of bounce off.
I've become better at it.
Okay.
Yeah. And I have so many people protecting me on there that it's a little bit easier.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the podcast before the hour's up?
Yes. It's called Caring for Tomorrow. I'm doing this for the Washington Post and the Cleveland Health Clinic. And we are talking about the future of healthcare. And so we tackle diseases, we tackle racial disparity and access to health care, we tackle things like telehealth and how it's going to change, and also how it will help us help doctors manage patients' chronic illnesses, because they'll be able to keep in touch all the time. People can't be like, it's the current model is not sustainable. The current model where a person, you know, calls to get an appointment with their doctor, they get it 3 months from now. They barely remember it when it comes time. Now they drive an hour. They take time off from work. They wait an hour in a doctor's office, and they're not even like cut open or anything. They just go in and see the doctor. That's not sustainable. So it's coming to the point where it has to change with the number of people and the number of doctors and an unsustainable model. So telehealth is going to, it might be a little scary in the beginning, like I'm not really in the doctor's office. But even with psychology, they feel that people are much more themselves and more willing to talk when they're home. So it is definitely going to be the future, and the time is going to come where, just like you browse through Amazon looking for which store has that 65-inch television screen for the best price, you are going to scroll through on the internet all the different medical institutions where you can get a specific surgery, or whether even if you go to India or some other country where you can get it. And on that, it will say whether your doctor speaks English, whether they are abiding by the same kind of regulations that we abide by here, and how much it will cost. And you'll be able to see. And if you can't maybe afford to go to the Cleveland Clinic or Johns Hopkins, you can still use telehealth to get a second opinion from one of the best experts in the world. And they can then be in touch with your doctor back home so you can get that operation at home, right by your home, and be comfortable. So it's going to enrich, as well as making the system just be able to be sustainable, it will enrich, I think, the way we all interact with the medical community.
Caring for Tomorrow.
Yes.
That's the podcast for the Washington Post.
September 30th, Evan. It's next week.
A couple of days away here. Yeah. The book is called Why Did I Come Into This Room? A Candid Conversation About Aging by Joan London. And Joan is the host of Second Opinion, which is shooting its new season right now here at WXXI this week. And those episodes start rolling out in January. And I know our listeners are going to be looking for that. I'm really grateful for the time. Thank you for making the time. And thanks for what you do. All the different things.
It was my pleasure, Evan. Thank you.
Joan London. Our thanks to Megan Mack, the producer and the engineer. How old are you feeling today? She's looking at me, shaking her head. No, not going to answer. I'm still saying 35. And I hope wherever you are, you're feeling as good as you can. And you're surrounded by love this afternoon, and we will talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.